The Athletic.
Hello, listener. I'm Carl Anker, and welcome to Talk of the Devils, the Manchester United podcast from The Athletic. This week, we'll be discussing a big interview conducted on The Athletic between super agents Mino Raiola and Jonathan Barnett, who are speaking together for the very first time. If you check this article out, Raiola gives his thoughts both on Paul Pogba and Sir Alex Ferguson, as well as a certain Norwegian football player. Plus, we're going to talk about cult heroes, discuss Nicky Butt's departure from the club, and answer some of your reader questions. Help me, as ever, make the best of all your Manchester United thoughts, questions, queries, and comments. They are the best strike partnership to ever go through Old Trafford since the days of York and Cole. First things up, it's my fellow beat reporter in United. It's Mr. Laurie Whitwell. Laurie, how are you doing?
Carl, I'm good, yes. Thanks for the analogy. I'm not going to say which one I might be, but it was a good interview, wasn't it, by Danny and James on the two agents, Raiola and Barnett. They certainly came up with some punchy stuff, so we'll get stuck into it. But some relevant stuff, I think, as well for Manchester United.
I want to also throw this over to the editor of United We Stand and contributing writer to The Athletic. It's Mr. Andy Mitten. Andy, this is a really interesting interview we've got here, isn't it?
Good. It's good to get them on the record because I think they've got a natural aversion to journalists, especially the British press. And they talk about that quite a lot within the interview. So it's good to get their view on it. I don't necessarily agree with some of what they say, but you can see why players adore them. And Raiola in particular has got a real bee in his bonnet about FIFA. So, yeah, it's interesting. I think it's just the type of stuff which The Athletic should be doing and is doing well.
Yes. And listener, if you have not already subscribed, you can do right now for the special price of $3.99 a month for the next 6 months. That's 40% off the price of a full subscription. You can enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. So, if you are interested in this interview and some other pieces we've got on The Athletic right now, Laurie's done a fantastic piece on Park Ji-sung. We'll get into it a little bit later. All you need to do is go to theathletic.com/ManUnitedPod to take advantage of this special 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/ManUnitedPod. Okay, it's time to talk about this interview in depth. This is done with Daniel Taylor and James Horncastle, who got on a Zoom call with two of the most powerful men in football, Mino Raiola and Jonathan Barnett. To get you started, here's Mino Raiola on United selling Pogba and then buying him back, and his thoughts on Sir Alex Ferguson.
When Ferguson criticised me, was my biggest compliment ever anybody could give me. Because Ferguson is used to people come in, especially with young boys, and then they say, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. And I only have to say that when Ferguson left, his owner, by buying back Paul Pogba, told me that I was right. Because I didn't want to take Paul Pogba away. He didn't believe in Paul Pogba. When Ferguson says, I don't like him, it's the biggest compliment that I could have. It's like saying Blatter says, I don't like him. Fantastic. I don't care what Ferguson says.
I think it's much more worrying if a player came out and said something against Mina.
Some strong stuff there. Raul is basically saying that the Glazers buying Pogba back once Ferguson had left was a pretty big indication of the player's talents, at least. Laurie, I want to throw this one to you first, because I think you've spent much of this season having to deal with some of Raiola's quotes, especially before a certain Champions League game. So what did you make of this conversation? What did you make of Mino Raiola and Barnett as agents?
I've spoken to Jonathan Barnett myself previously and over Luke Shaw, actually, which he goes on to speak about. But yeah, never heard from Mino Raiola personally, but you can tell certainly from speaking to the guys that he tried. Yeah.
Let's clarify that.
Yeah, have called him numerous times, but you know, listen, he's a busy man, got lots of people to speak to. And I think this was a long time coming, this particular interview, you know, a lot of hard work into actually getting them on the record. It's not an easy thing for sure. I mean, listen, it sounded like Raiola was putting his thoughts across quite forcefully, quite repeatedly. It was quite, you know, a bit of a comedic tone to it, I think, when trying to get a word in edgeways against him. Clearly, he is somebody who knows his mind and is not afraid to say it and has been that way for a long, long time. And yeah, the stuff on Pogba was interesting for sure. It speaks, I suppose, to the structures at United and the way that the dynamic totally shifted when Ferguson left in that regard. You know, we did a piece earlier this season where we spoke to people close to events at the time when Pogba left and Raiola's role in that. And then the fact that, you know, if Sir Alex Ferguson was still at the club, Paul Pogba wouldn't have been re-signed because he would have been with Mino Raiola. of selling or letting someone leave for free and then buying them back for a hell of a lot of money wouldn't have sat well with Ferguson and the way that he was trying to shape his team and build a team and build a squad cohesion. Him going, you know, enabled United to look at the situation again. And I think certainly as soon as Ferguson retired that summer of 2013, they did explore the prospects. But nevertheless, he stayed at Juventus and, you know, ended up coming across in 2016. But I think, yeah, what Raiola says there is you have to pay attention to it because he is such a powerful agent. He's got, you know, clients from, you know, all walks of life, and he understands players and people, I think, pretty well, and clearly has their priorities at the forefront of his mind and also his own. He's not shy about saying that he wants to make a few bucks himself. But the Pogba issue reminds us all that he has, you know, he will have a part to play this summer if Pogba stays or if Pogba goes. And then also, you know, beyond that, you know, when if he does enter his last year of his contract, will United try and offer him another extension? Will he sign it? And what will happen, you know, if he does end up going on a free the summer afterwards? You know, Raiola will, I think he says at one point he plans, or actually it's Jonathan Barnett that says his admiration for how Raiola plans his players' careers and also their moves. And you can be reassured that he will have thought of every different eventuality for Pogba staying, you know, extending or going.
Andy, I want to get your thoughts here. Both Raiola and Barnett are termed as quote-unquote super agents. Do you think such a working relationship can work at a club at Manchester United where previously they've had players such as Paul Scholes and Gary Neville who more or less didn't have agents in the past?
The model has changed, and clubs, top clubs like United, need to be in cahoots with top agents. And you saw not long after Ed Woodward came in, George Mendes's daughter did work experience at Old Trafford. And if you control the talent, then you could argue that you control where the league titles go. Obviously, there are many variable factors within that. But the days of Ferguson's autocracy have long gone. When he said a decade ago, there's no value in the market, it's not for any individual to say whether there's a value or not. Just because he'd been so powerful and had excelled and got players punching well above their weight, he was in this almighty powerful position. And he was identifying the right players, such as Karim Benzema, and then deciding that it wasn't worth paying for him what Real Madrid were to pay for him. I think Fergie was actually wrong there, because Benzema has been one of the best strikers in world football. And Pogba got offered a very good deal, but it wasn't good enough for Raiola. And Fergie pulled all the stops out. He sent players round to his house in Sale. And players love Raiola because he's all about the player. It's all about what is best for you. Not the club, not the fans, the player. And we all speak to agents, and I had lunch with a very good one on Friday, and I think he's exceptionally good at his job. What's he good at? Negotiating. It's all about the player. It's all about, why is he not being picked more? Why is he not playing more? Why has the manager not said this about him? And he's almost like a social worker, and he's worked with some top players. And players' rights and wages have increased so much that you look at my uncle Charlie left Manchester United in 1950 because his beef was, I get paid £10 a week and I play in front of 50,000 people every week. Where's the money going? And he felt that players were serfs and had no rights. So he moved to Colombia on £100 a week, 10 times his salary. And he played with some of the best players in the world, and he got offered a chance to go to Real Madrid. And players' rights gradually increased in the 60s, and there were notable people like Jimmy Hill was part of it, George Easton, and then the Bosman. All of these things have added to the power of players. But my Uncle Charlie was a big Manchester United star, and when he finished playing, he didn't have enough money to buy a car. There's something wrong with that. And he went to his grave being, maybe bitter's too strong a word, but I've only been asked for money twice in my life as a journalist to do an interview. And one of them was of my own uncle. And he said, Martin Edwards owes me £100. And Martin Edwards was the Man United chairman. And I said, he wasn't even born when you moved to Colombia. So he held a grudge. And you might find players from the 90s being envious of what the players in the noughties earned, and every generation. And these agents, it's all about the player. So when Beckham first negotiated his professional contract, his dad didn't know what to do. So Ferguson decided the figure. Ferguson would basically say, there you go, son, sign that. And in hindsight, those players could have got a lot, lot more money. Now, the club's argument was, be patient here, the money will follow. And it did do. So there's two sides to it. But you can see why these hustlers, these very, very good negotiators, their ideal scenario is if you get a Haaland-type player and you can go to the top six clubs in the world and say, who's going to pay me the most? That's their dream scenario. And a lot of them are very good with languages. They've got contacts all around Europe. It's not a domestic game now. The main agents in the UK in the 80s, people like Dennis Roach, they fell way by the wayside. It became these international movers and shakers. Laurie said, a good people person. You know, Georgie Mendes worked in a disco. He's a good people person. Players are attracted to certain types of people. Mino Raiola was in a pizzeria, and they work their backsides up for their players. They do everything for the players. Doesn't always work out. Did Jesse Lingard work out going with Mino? I don't think it did. I don't think Mino got him a deal as good as going to West Ham and being really good at West Ham. So it's not an exact science. Football lends itself to disappointment, but these people are hugely influential and powerful. And it's all right, fans saying, tell him where to go, never deal with him again. Okay, I'm finished ninth.
There's the balance. There's an excellent bit in this interview where Jonathan Barnett talks about how his group, the Stella Group, has their own analytics department. So Barnett representing Luke Shaw, discussing an analytics department that is on par with at least the Athletics Group, if not some of the top football groups in the world.
Yeah,
what do you think about that?
He said he hired them from a club, didn't he? A couple of people, analytics people. And I found that really interesting in the sense of, you know, the fact that they're not just about transfers. You know, these big agencies have got a support network. They've got, you know, links with PR people so that they can make sure that their clients get good interviews in certain places. You know, that's not always to do with the club. You know, but it's equally only at the, you know, they have quite a decent amount of control, I think, over those kind of situations. So they want to present their client in the best possible light. So, you know, that's a public facing thing. And also, as you say, internally behind the scenes, if they can actually work with their player, how much value is that giving the player, you know, to sort of show, you know, actually, we're going to give you a tailored, you know, bit of footage or whatever it might be. And obviously, the, you know, Manchester United will obviously do that as well. But it's just that additional layer, I suppose, that, you know, brings fidelity from a player to an agency and genuine worth. You know, we can see, you know, Luke Shaw has improved this season. I'd certainly say that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and the coaching team have a large part to play. But clearly, if he's got support from elsewhere, when, you know, his manager previously, you know, Jose Mourinho wasn't, you know, particularly helpful in public, you know, was certainly privately saying some pretty harsh things. And was it always constructive? I know that Jose thrives on that kind of confrontational sense of improvement. But, you know, when you actually need more considered support and probably, you know, a bit more of a visualization of what, you know, you need to do, I think certainly Stella provided that personally. Yeah, I found that aspect to it really interesting, because as Andy says, you know, we can all, you know, slate agents for taking money out of the game. And certainly I think, you know, Danny and James put that question to Jonathan and Mino Raiola. And I think they answered it robustly, as you'd expect them to. You know, they've got this big fight with FIFA on the cards at the moment, and that's obviously their main thrust for bookend the interview. But I think also they do clearly provide other things other than just, you know, sorting out transfers. It's a rounded kind of facility that they're now giving players.
Let's talk about transfers or possible transfers. Jonathan Barnett represents Luke Shaw, but he also represents Jack Grealish. Mino Raiola has a very impressive slate of football players, including Paul Pogba. He had a little segment in this interview where he goes, Pogba has a fantastic appeal worldwide. I heard from Manchester United that he's appreciated, also from Solskjaer's side. Today, if someone asked me, can you find a club for Paul? I could take my nephew of 5 years and find a club for Paul at a high level, which sounds like a a man very confident in his abilities. Listener, if you have not checked it out yet, I highly recommend Zlatan's Ibrahimovic's autobiography. There's a segment in there where he describes the move he goes from Barcelona to AC Milan and what Mino Raiola does there. And there's another segment where he goes for a contract negotiation and Mino Raiola works, quote unquote, like a mafioso to get him a brand new deal. So I recommend those two segments for you. There's also another quote here from the interview we've just done from Raiola that I think is really interesting for both sides of Manchester. I want to leave this one open to both Andy and Laurie if you want to chip in here. It goes, I don't give an F if I never do another player with Man United. I'm not in their hands. I'm independent. Guardiola, I've closed the book a long time ago. Everyone knows what I think of him personally. He can say what he thinks for me personally. Now, Mino Raiola represents Haaland, who is going to be much sought after this summer, might even stay at Borussia Dortmund. What do we make of those quotes?
I thought it was a little bit telling on the Manchester City side, to be honest. I know that he has sort of mentioned Guardiola again, and clearly there's been issues there in the past. You know, notably, I did a piece recently on the derby from 2018 when Pogba was the subject of sort of pre-match talk, and Guardiola sort of threw him under the bus a little bit. You know, he was offering, Raiola was offering Pogba to City, and it, you know, there was some pretty serious words said there. So clearly there's no love lost, but I think the way that he tempered what he said about City and Guardiola maybe just gives us a hint as to, you know, that maybe there's something else going on there. Whereas a little bit with United, and listen, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but he you know, specifically says, you know, I don't give an F, you know, I don't give a fuck if I never do another play with Manchester United. Let's give it the full expletive, because he's not watered down his words. And, you know, I think that does, clearly this is somebody who says, you know, what he thinks and isn't, you know, he goes into boardrooms where, you know, usually it's, you know, suits and sort of, you know, formal expressions and kind of perhaps a bit euphemistic, some of the language. He clearly doesn't, you know, sugarcoat anything. He says it in a very mundane kind of way. But I think for me, that sort of suggested, you know, it was quite aggressive, quite a, you know, a riposte really. So I just wonder if that does have a part to play with Erling Haaland. I know I've sort of written previously that City feel like they've got the upper hand. Certainly a couple of sources have said that City feel like they've got the upper hand in the Haaland pursuit. And I don't know, that this paragraph sort of made me think, is that what's going on here? Listen, like I say, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but just a thought.
And do you want to get your thoughts here? Both on possibly both players, Mino Raiola has that are Manchester interested, both Pogba and Haaland. What do you think?
Full of people who do U-turns. Wasn't that great enmity between Roy Keane and Niall Quinn? And didn't they then end up working together as manager and chairman at Sunderland? And Sir Alex Ferguson has given some quotes about, you know, grown-up men not bearing grudges, despite him holding grudges with the best of them. These agents can afford to say things like that about one club. They couldn't do it about eight clubs, because realistically, how many people will be in the market for Haaland? And the Spanish market is more deflated, even though you read the Spanish press and he's on the front pages every day. I think the economic power is shifting towards the Premier League. So he's got to have good relations with the biggest English clubs. He can't burn bridges with United, City, Liverpool and Chelsea, the type of people who could afford to pay the top wages. But he's a street hustler, and it's one reason why a lot of the players really like him, because they're working class lads, they can relate to him. And if you look, as Laurie touched on, at the how most boardrooms are made up, they're not working class lads, they're university educated. Look at Manchester United with all the Bristol Uni connections. And that's why I think it's good that someone like Darren Fletcher's in there to be involved. He can talk on a football language. Not that he will be the one negotiating with the agents. That would still be Matt Judge. So there's still, you've still got that odd interface. And I think with Guardiola, he's done U-turns several times on players. He speaks. I've seen him speak so well publicly of some players. I know for a fact he fell out with at Barcelona. And why did he leave Barcelona in the first place? Because he was worn out by it. And it was his players who wore him out. and they've worn out other managers, and the managerial fuse is a short one at a club like Barca. And when he went away and reflected on it and have had time away from the club, then he could come back and say, Lionel Messi is the greatest ever, blah, blah, blah. But there were times when there was a huge amount of tension within that relationship. And people fall out in football all the time. It's such a subjective industry because you're talking about analytics and metrics becoming more important, and they are, but so much of it is still subjective. There's so many people who say, I'm not having him, doesn't know what he's doing. And it's just based on whims. It's based on professional jealousy, on personal rivalries. And football's full of cliques as well. Their job is to get the best deal for their players. They do a good job of it. That is why they have become super agents. There are thousands of people who want to be agents. It's such an unregulated market. And most of them, the vast majority of them, do not have the talent. These fellas, they have the talent. They are holding the diamonds. If Manchester United signed Haaland, you would suspect that they would become maybe not the favourites to win the league, but there would be like a 10% jump. That would be the perception. And these people come at an absolute premium. With Pogba, you can argue it both ways. We've praised him, we've criticised him. You could say he was right to get him out of United. There was a game against Blackburn when Pogba felt he should have started because United were injury hit, and Fergie started two defenders in the middle. United lost the game against a team who were going down. Really, in hindsight, it was a really damaging result. And if I was Paul Pogba, I would have thought, my future's clearly not here. Doesn't matter whether I'm being offered to be paid more than any other reserve player. And he went to Juventus and established himself quickly in the first team. So he can feel absolutely vindicated in leaving United, and so can Raiola. And if Fergie wants to say nasty things about him, it's war off a duck's back, and vice versa. You know, humans don't have to like each other, especially in such a competitive environment where finishing second brings criticism.
Let's talk about the possible moves that either men could be involved in over the summer. Could any club apart from City or United afford Haaland? Could any club apart from United or City indeed afford someone like Jack Grealish, who's under Stellar Group? We've had two or three press conferences from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer where he's been quite cagey with his cards close to his chest about how much money is available at Manchester United. But could there be a blue chip signing on the way?
Yeah, one marquee signing has certainly been the suggestion. And then the rest, I suppose, dependent on whether sales are made and to what level. So that, for me, you looking at their accounts and the fact that they have been robust with the commercial, you know, deals, you know, they've got a new shirt sponsorship. So that's sorted for the next few years. That does mean that they should be able to make a solid signing, like a proper signing. I don't think another signing of a Donny van de Beek would quite cut it, would quite fit, you know, what the idea behind United are trying to do, and certainly what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is trying to do in terms of bridging that gap to Man City. Because the only way, really, clearly players can improve. We can all have questions about whether Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is ultimately the manager to get United there. But clearly the way to best close that gap to Manchester City, who have, you know, consistently spent and added quality, established quality to that squad for a number of years, is to go out and buy some proper established players that you know for a fact can come into the team and hit the ground running. So that's why, for me personally, you know, a Jack Grealish would be, you know, perfect. I'm not saying that I know exactly how he'd fit into the team or where he would play, because listen, that's another debate. But I just feel like a player that creates like he does, that adds something different to a team, that can dribble, that can do different things than what United have already got, and has performed at the Premier League now for 2 years, you know, holding Aston Villa on his shoulders to a large degree. He's ready. You know, he showed for England that he's got that ability to step up. And I wonder what will happen this summer. I mean, maybe that's, you know, one of the, Jonathan Barnett at one point talks about, you know, a few transfers that he thinks will happen that are a significant amount of money. And maybe that is one that he's thinking of. I don't know. You know, I'm sort of reading between the lines a little bit here, but you hear, you know, Manchester United have definitely got Jack Grealish on the radar. He's not going to go away. Manchester City also, you know, they've had him on the radar for a while. So you're sort of looking at him thinking, could it be another, you know, head-to-head situation established? That being said, you know, he signed a new contract last year. Jack Grealish, again, you know, stellar agency will have negotiated that. Jonathan Bartnett's partner, David Manasseh, I think is the one that perhaps has a closer relationship with Jack Grealish and his family. And so that then you wonder, the level of the pay that he's on at Aston Villa, how much is that a factor in where he goes? And also, you know, clearly Aston Villa would want, you know, if they would even countenance a sale, and we've seen how important he is to the team now that he's been out the side, you know, they would want a hell of a lot of money. You know, I'd be reluctant to put a figure on it exactly. But if United go and sign that Jack Grealish, he would be the one, you know, marquee name. He would be that calibre. Erling Haaland, obviously, you know, would also undoubtedly be that. I think probably the pool for him is a little bit wider than just, you know, United and City. I mean, Bayern Munich certainly would have the resources. Chelsea certainly having a look at him. And I know we've, you know, that they have the money for sure. So, you know, it would, yeah, I think is he on record as saying 10 clubs are looking at Haaland? Maybe it's not as many as that could actually then go and do the deal. Because certainly he and the player will be demanding a lot of remuneration, you know, in salary, and you know, justifiably so given the pedigree that he's got. But yeah, I think the number of clubs is probably a pretty small pool. But yeah, definitely United and City in there, and they are right. You know, these guys know what they're talking about when they're looking ahead to the summer transfer window and the kind of money that will need to change hands to make these deals happen.
Andy, the football season ends at the end of May. You've got the European Championships, and then next season, 2021-2022, starts on the 14th of August, I believe, which I think is a couple of days earlier than scheduled. Is this going to be a busy transfer window, or is it still everyone's skin?
I think prices will be down, but you might get a merry-go-round effect where one club pays a lot of money and that money is then circulated among some of the biggest clubs. Fergie always said the best players are the hardest ones to get. He didn't like it when a player came easily. And United, going to what Laurie says, you do need a Bruno-class player. If you're looking back at last season's transfer window, could you say now that it was a big success? I couldn't with great conviction. There's been times this season where we've been more optimistic. But if you're Bruno, you want world-class players around you. And if you're Jack Grealish, you want to win trophies. And he's done really well at Aston Villa, and Aston Villa have done really well under Dean Smith. But they ain't winning the European Cup like they did in 82 again. So Manchester United would operate on a far different pay scale to somebody like Aston Villa. Manchester City, to their credit, have backed down on a few transfers. They've got a pretty rigid pay structure. And if they were to go for a Haaland, they'd have to smash their own pay structure. United and City both went or were interested in Harry Maguire, Alexis Sanchez, and it was City who pulled back. And I spoke to an agent who dealt with them, and he just said they'd have to break their pay structure if they wanted Haaland. I don't think we'll be seeing three world-class players joining Manchester United, but I think it's really important that we see one. And I keep going back to that conversation I had at the start of the season about Donny van der Beek. It wasn't one where I was filled with conviction. It's like he's been brought in to bolster the squad, and the midfield has become more of an issue there. If you're going to compete with the absolute best, United's team, I think, needs to be strengthened. And there's always other factors. You know, how good will James Garner be? I'm told he's not ready yet at all. And how good will youth player A, youth player B, youth player C? But Ollie's going to be judged on whether he's challenging for the title next season or not. And at the moment, Manchester City are away in front. If United can be smart, move a couple of players on, you know, get 20 million for a couple of players from Premier League teams, there's players there who probably don't have a big future at Manchester United who've got a good resale. Jesse Lingard's done himself no harm whatsoever in his form at West Ham. He's proved that he can play for a very good Premier League team, and then use some of that money, as well as the money that's been generated, and the team viewer deal's definitely been viewed positively. You'd have the optimism of fans coming back into the stadium. I spoke to Richard Arnold 2 weeks ago. He had a very optimistic outlook. Maybe wishful thinking as well, like we all are, because we want fans to come back in, but it would all lead to United being in a better position than most other clubs. However, Spanish clubs have been written off before. Manchester United thought they had Ronaldinho in 2003. And the reason they thought they had him, A, because he gave them his word and actually said, I'm coming, and actually said to Cleberson, join Manchester, I'm going there. And B, they didn't think Barca had the money, because they didn't. But Barca and Madrid enjoy very favourable credit lines with authority, with banks. I wouldn't be absolutely stunned if, however much we've written off Barca for their financial problems, they have some sort of new deal. Maybe money from abroad, maybe money coming in from, you know, Saudi, Qatar, the Emirates, whatever. And suddenly they can go out and buy like they've always bought. But United should be there. I don't think we're going to be seeing the 120 millions asked of from Jadon Sancho. But you'd be expecting, you know, a 70 million. Laurie, is that fair?
That's what I would gauge as when, you know, when told, you know, a significant transfer, I think that's a fair reflection. And you know, will that be enough to get a Grealish? You know, it probably won't be enough to get a Haaland, given his release clause isn't activated till next summer. Yeah, Sancho, you're not going to go through a whole summer of wanting him and then sort of totally, you know, say, no, he's not one for us the next summer. You know, he's obviously somebody that they're still looking at, even though they, you know, United went and bought Ahmad. Could United go and get cheaper options than, but still quality options than some of the other players? Can they box a bit cleverly? You know, I know you and I, Carl, have discussed Dominic Calvert-Lewin as an alternative, you know, striker to Erling Haaland. Clearly, he's, you know, it looks like he's not at the kind of European pedigree level that Erling Haaland is, but he's a good striker, and he's the kind of striker that United have, you know, said they want, you know, particularly with Edison Cavani's future being unclear. So I suppose that's what I would think about. And then, yeah, I suppose the one player I hadn't mentioned was Harry Kane. You know, he is certainly someone that, you know, is being looked at by a number of clubs. His future at Spurs feels uncertain, but then he's got 3 years left on his deal. You know, it was a 6-year contract that he signed, you know, obviously 3 years ago. And that, again, just sort of makes it more difficult if you then decide as a player, okay, my club aren't looking like they're going to win trophies. I don't feel like I can fulfill my full potential in silverware terms here. I would like to move on. That's where you feel like, you know, would... It's a question. I don't know. I'm not criticising Harry Kane for signing the contract, because I think anybody, you know, with a good deal in front of them would do so. But you sort of wonder, was that him knowingly locking himself into Spurs for the foreseeable, basically? Could, you know, Raiola talks about, you know, those planning, you know, steps that go in place. You know, he got a release clause in Erling Haaland's contract. That's why United, you know, walked away from the deal that took him to Dortmund. You know, is that something that these agents will always think about? So, you know, whenever a player signs a contract, there's always interesting sort of dynamics to it. And certainly from United's perspective this summer, it just means, you know, that they're going to have to search hard, because I think it's an important summer, this one. You know, I don't think that they can look at it and go, well, the pandemic's hit us. We've got a bit of a reason maybe to be cautious. Yeah, obviously you've got to be sensible, but at the same time, if you don't have the idea that you need to be challenging for the title at the forefront of your mind, then I think that allows a little bit of ease to creep in and a little bit of, you know, satisfaction at second best. And I think that would turn next season into a difficult situation.
You mentioned Dominic Calvert-Lewin, who lives in Manchester, by the way. Would he like to join United? Well, what do you think? Look where he scores his goals, right? They're all very, very close. And it's the type of play United are missing. United have obviously looked at him and every other striker in the past. Has he been viewed as being United class? I wouldn't say. Is he Haaland class? I wouldn't say that he is. And do Everton need to sell like they used to do? No. Everton have got serious money now. So even to get Lukaku out of Everton cost a lot of money. And if Calvert-Lewin signed, would he be seen as the top class striker? Probably. But not Sancho level. I think Jack Grealish, I think he would be. But I think Calvert-Lewin is definitely improving. And I just know that United have looked at him in the past and they've not seen him as someone who they thought, we've got to get him.
Well, there's just a celebratory atmosphere at Old Trafford. This could be any score. Here's Park. Young takes on Jenkinson. Back to Park. Jason Park! Arsenal's nemesis has struck, and Arsenal have been hit for six at Old Trafford. United 6, Arsenal 1.
Laurie, I want to talk to you about another piece you've done this week on Park Ji-sung. It's Cult Hero Week on The Athletic over the international break, and for Manchester United, you chose the South Korean midfielder. Why?
Well, we had a few, didn't we? We discussed it. Anderson was one that we thought. Obviously, Diego Forlan, a couple of people that Andy knows really well. And I suppose this idea of cult heroism, Adam Hurry, who does, you know, the Football Clichés podcasts and is a very funny guy, he was the one that kind of did the piece defining what a cult hero is. And it's kind of somebody that is popular. Well, he's fiercely popular amongst the fan base, but he's not necessarily the top level player that you kind of, you know, he's not a legend. So you know, I think certainly, you know, Forlan and Anderson fall into those categories. Maybe Park was actually too good a player to be a cult hero as such, because he did, you know, he stayed at the club for a long time and won pretty much everything you can win. Player, when you reflect back and you look at the fact that, you know, he didn't play all that regularly. I think it was only twice in seven seasons that he played more than 20 Premier League games, you sort of think, okay, fair enough. He's of a sounds odd to say, doesn't it? But he's of a certain level that is yet below the top tier, so that you can categorize him as a kind of cult hero. And he definitely did cultivate a certain affection amongst fans, a real kind of warmth from people because of the amount of energy that he put into matches, and the way that he was dignified as well. You know, gets dropped from the squad from the 2008 Champions League final, having played an important part in getting United there, not least in the semi-final against Barcelona, and responds by saying, yes, it's, you know, disappointing, but my team won, so I'm happy and there'll be other opportunities. And, you know, he was right. You know, he then played in the final in 2009. Obviously, I know that didn't go as well, but he had the chance, didn't he, on the rebound, which studying back to his footage, I found, because I watched all his goals and all his assists for United, and he scored, he had a good knack for the rebound, for chasing in shots, you know, and certainly, you know, I'm sure that kind of play would have a role in this current team. You know, the idea of moving towards the goal when another player's having a shot. And yet, you know, we obviously had a song about him that probably in today's standards wouldn't pass the taste test, for sure. But it was, at the time, it felt kind of fun. And, you know, and certainly against Liverpool, any song that, you know, has Liverpool in, you know, it's going to be a bit of more popular, I suppose. But no, I spoke to Eric Steele for it, obviously who Andy and I know, and he's, you know, a really enjoyable guy to speak to every time. He comes out with some really colourful language, and he just said about Park that, you know, he was a bit of a ratter. Arsenal would hate him because he would always get about them. You know, he'd always give 100% energy, and he would do a task specifically. So he said that if, you know, United were playing against a team that had a good fullback, a good winger, you could put Park on that side, and he basically shut that down, you know, single-handedly. And that kind of player was so important for a manager like Sir Alex Ferguson, for any manager really, that you can depend on not only to do the stuff out of possession, but to do the stuff in possession. He was good off either foot. He had scored five headers, I think. So, you know, it's a weird, you know, he's only 5'8", but he scored a good number in the air. And yeah, just a joyful player, had a smile on his face. And what Eric Steele did say to me was that, you know, every time you heard laughter in the dressing room, you could be pretty sure that it was Carlos Tevez, Patrice Everett and Park Ji-sung, which just amused me. You know, it's such an unlikely trio. He says that Spanish was the link. I don't know, Andy, did you know that Park spoke Spanish? Are you going to correct him?
I'll never understand this. And these three were the best of mates. And Patrice learned some words of Korean, and Carlos didn't really speak English, and they just got on brilliantly. And stayed in touch long after they'd stopped playing. And I think when G's, one of his parents passed away, Patrice went to Korea for the funeral. I mean, it really goes beyond a few nice likes on social media. They are very, very close. And I love it how sometimes these friendships. There was a really mad one with David Beckham and Roberto Carlos at Real Madrid. And I spoke to Carlos Queiroz, who was a manager, years later. And he said, to this day, I've still not been able to work out how they became close friends, because they couldn't speak a mutual language. And they'd sit there after training for an hour each day. And he said, I still can't work it out. You know, what were they looking at? What were they talking about? Someone said to me, oh, just be talking about birds. But I don't know whether that's true or not. But football throws up these relationships, which shows it's just not about language. But yeah, Park, Tevez and Evra, the most unlikely combination. And all three of them were fantastic players for Manchester United. Carlos Tevez was, I wouldn't say underrated because he was appreciated, but history went against him because of who he joined. He was a brilliant United player. United should have done more to get him. That said, 7 or 8 years after he'd gone, some of his teammates were still talking about how much money he earned at Manchester City.
And we're back to agents, aren't
we're
we?
Back to agents, yeah.
With Jurabchian. You know, he's had his run-ins with Gary Neville, for example, on Sky. But you know, there you go. He did his work for the player. You know, rubbed Ferguson up the wrong way, but you know, his player is satisfied, went on to win another title.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah. Do we remember that? Did that happen?
I don't know. There's some guy called Aguero who I don't know if he's carrying on next season or not, but I think he played up front for City. But my brain is with like the lockdown has just managed to delete absolutely everything since Aguero left Atletico Madrid, where he played up front with Forlan, who was another cult hero, as you say.
Let's get into some of the listener questions. Thank you, as ever, every Tuesday morning when we ask the questions, you inundate us with some really, really fun ones. One of the first questions we've got here is from Gabriel Johnson at GabsJ, who goes, I'd like to consider the resignation of Nicky Butt. Are there any internal concerns about the brand new setup? Laurie, you've been covering the brand new setup at Manchester United involving Darren Fletcher and John Murta. Nicky Butt left not soon after.
It's always difficult when these sort of situations arise. You're sort of trying to figure out what's gone on. And listen, there's obviously a few different factors here, and not least is, you know, Nicky Butt's desire to try something new challenge. Definitely wants to remain in coaching, I'm told. And listen, people are speculating, could he become a manager somewhere? There's obviously different ideas. And I think Twitter was furious with them, wasn't it, on the night that his departure was announced, and Celtic and Derby and even Salford were mentioned. I don't think he had anything lined up particularly, and listen, if one of those things comes off in time, then great. But yeah, it's not something that he was going into another job, and yeah, the appointments of John Murta and Darren Fletcher were, I think, a factor in Nicky Butt's decision to depart with a heavy heart. I think with John Murta, they are just different people, you know, have a different approach to things in football. Not saying, you know, one way is the absolute best and the other way is, you know, the absolute worst, but you know, Nicky Butt obviously bases his on his playing career, and we talk about Mina Rola there saying things how they are, and Nicky Butt certainly spoke in that kind of language. You know, I've had a couple of interviews with him in the past year or so where, you know, he doesn't shirk around subjects, he tackles them head on. You know, you can see how his opinions are so strong that, you know, when somebody like John Murta is there sort of suggesting other solutions, that they can clash, and you know, a bit of a personality clash, I suppose. So his promotion to become a sort of line manager really for Nicky Butt was something that I don't think Nicky Butt, you know, was pleased by. And also just in general, you know, the role that Darren Fletcher's got, this technical director role. You know, Nicky Butt's been at the club for 9 years now as a coach, you know, academy head, now head of first team development. So got a really, you know, good relationship with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, picking players that might be ready for the first team, and also being able to speak to them with the kind of authenticity that I think is really valuable at a club like Manchester United. You know, he's obviously been there and done it himself. And I know, you know, I'm not saying that you have to be a player to be in that role, or that you should be always reflecting back on how things were done in my day. You know, football moves on for sure, but I think there's a massive part for people that have experienced those things that understand implicitly what it takes to succeed at Manchester United, and to then speak to players and, you know, give them a bit of a tongue lashing when they need to. So I think Nicky Butt did have hopes that he could, you know, ascend to that kind of role. And the fact that, you know, it was then Darren Fletcher instead, you know, and John Murta combined, I think just left him with a bit of an impression of, okay, maybe my time's up at Manchester United. But I think it's quite sad. And I think it was a heavy heart that he made the decision. And I think you can see from the quotes that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer gave and Nick Cox, United's academy head, the warmth that Nicky Butt is regarded in at Manchester United. And he will always be welcome back.
Nicky Butt's generally regarded as sort of the older brother figure out the class of 92. Andy, I'm going to assume you've interviewed him once or twice before.
Yeah, I know him. I've spoke to him since last Wednesday. My first reaction when I heard that he was leaving was one of sadness, and I've not changed that view. I think he was doing a good job at United, did a great job as a player. He tells it how it is. He's a lad from Gorton. You know, he's not someone who's got much interest in dealing with the media. I've known him for a long time. First interviewed him in 1994, did a trip to Asia with him a few years ago. So I've spent 5 days with him. And, you know, as Laurie touched upon, you have issues sometimes within a club and within any workplace. And to anybody listening to this, do you get on with everyone who you work with? People see things differently. People just have different views of things. I've spoke to John Murta. I like John. I get on with John. John's definitely got his talents as well. And you're in this ultra-competitive environment and both doing the best for Manchester United. You don't have to necessarily chime in and agree with everything. But I thought that Nick was, you know, he was good to some players. If you ask Axel Tuansbe, for example, who the most influential person he was for him at Manchester United, he'd probably say Nicky Butt. And also the coaches like Nicky Butt as well, because they felt that he'd speak up for them. You know, some of them coaches, they've obviously got good jobs and they're well paid, but they're not financially set for life. So they can't really risk and be as outspoken as they might be, like Nicky Butt might be, because he could ultimately just walk away from it. And he has left the club. And I think he's definitely got talents. I don't know what he'll do next. Don't think he's in any rush to do anything. He's keeps himself to himself. He's close to Roy Keane, mm-hmm. probably closer to Keane than anybody. So I saw all the speculation. I saw mates of mine saying, what's he doing now? He must be doing this. He must be doing that. And I just thought, I'm so glad I've taken a day off today. That is my get out clause for this, truthfully.
So you didn't put a tenner on the Celtic job or anything like that?
Absolutely didn't. And I saw friends of mine talking about it. I spoke to Nick and then I just thought, no. And switched my phone off and thought, I'm bowing out of this one for today. Pretty sad, because as much as I think that, you know, Darren Fletcher is an asset to the club, and we've spoke about that, I think that, you know, losing Nicky Butt could be a negative for the club as well. And I saw the statements that go out. Well, it's typical of a statement that any large company puts out, isn't it? Thank you very much and see you later. So I wish him well. He's a great player and he's done a good job at Manchester United. And I hope that John Murta does well too with Darren Fletcher.
Andy, we've got another question here from Marty Smith at Marty. That was fun to say. Any progress on stadium refurbishment or modernisation? I know this is a subject of interest to you. Is Old Trafford going to get a new lick of paint anytime soon?
Well, it's had a lick of paint. It's had tens of millions spent on it rather than hundreds of millions. And I think fans will notice changes when they go back. There's new disabled areas which have slightly reduced the capacity from 76 down to just over 73,000. The big issue, and I've written about it many times, and I've put this to people like Ed Woodward and Richard Arnold, is when is Old Trafford going to be completed, if you like? Because you've got these three huge stands, triple tiers on three sides, and then you've got the main stand, which is pretty small. And there's always been engineering issues with regards to putting another deck on the main stand. I've seen plans going back about increasing the capacity. And I felt that there has definitely been a demand there for Old Trafford to be bigger. So you're looking at it from an aesthetic perspective, but mm-hmm. also from a financial perspective. Of course, the outlay would be hundreds of millions to increase the capacity. And it can be done. And I wrote lots about it before the pandemic. Would the Glazers want to be investing that huge amount of money, especially with them coming from an environment where stadiums tend to be built with public money in the United States and not really in the UK? I don't see anything happening at the moment. I think Old Trafford was getting a bit shabby. I think it has been smartened up a little bit. I hope that some of my articles touched a nerve, because to see paint peeling off the girders was pretty embarrassing. I look at Real Madrid redoing their stadium and taking advantage of the COVID and no games being needed there, and think Man United could have taken advantage of that as well. But at the moment, with the finances as they are, I just think that the stadium redevelopment is absolutely not a priority. What the main thing is getting fans back into the stadium. And we'll talk about it in the future. I'm sure I'll write about it in the future. I'm a complete stadium geek. I could talk about any stadium in Europe. And I'd love to Old Trafford to be the best stadium. But United are not the only ones. Barcelona have been talking about doing their ground now for a decade. They were due to start in September 17. Absolutely, it's all been done. Well, that's 3.5 years ago. And one new brick has not been laid.
Another question here for you, Laurie. Since you are the maestro of the internal makeup of Manchester United, we've got a question from Jace who says, what is Mike Phelan's role at the club these days? Is he fulfilling a vital function? Or now that Ollie's settled in, he can sort of relax a little bit?
Yeah, well, Jace mentioned sort of, would they be better bringing in a young up-and-comer? And listen, I appreciate where Jace is coming from, but it does make me slightly chuckle when I hear sort of these ideas of, okay, it should always be a new, exciting, you know, sort of young, fresh face in the building. I just think you can't overlook a guy like Mike Phelan's experience. You know, the fact that he's been a player at United, that he's been a coach at United for a number of years, in the times that United have been very, very successful as well. So he knows, he understands what it takes to, you know, put a team together, and sort of beyond the kind of technical, tactical stuff, you know, just sort of the feeling of a place and the kind of characters that you need, the kind of little one-liners that you might need to say in certain moments to alleviate difficult situations, or the strong words that need to be said. Sort of on a kind of contemporary basis right now, I think what happens is, you know, you've got Michael Carrick and Kieran McKenna sort of leading the training sessions that have been set, you know, with Solskjaer and Phelan kind of watches on from the sides, gets involved if he sees that tempo needs to kind of pick up. It's sort of similar during matches as well. I know that Kieran McKenna does this quite a lot, but Phelan is often the guy, you know, sort of at the edge of the technical area. If he sees something that needs changing, you know, he speaks to the players and kind of, you know, tries to give them specific instructions on that. And he is involved in certain decision-making processes within, you know, at Carrington, you know, appointments that might be made. He'll be sort of on board, I think, to kind of, you know, on the interview process. And looking at players, you know, for example, he went and looked at Jude Bellingham play against West Brom last season in the Championship, liked him, you know, sort of United then pursued the player, and obviously went to Borussia Dortmund. He obviously went with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to watch Bruno Fernandes. So, you know, that kind of first-hand look at a player with his own eyes, you know, he's a trusted guy in that respect. So I certainly wouldn't be putting Phelan out to pasture just yet. And in fact, actually, he did an interview with the Man United podcast recently, last couple of weeks, I think it was. So maybe, Jace, you know, have a look at that. And it sort of gives you a bit more of a flavour of what he's about and the kind of character that he is. So I think it was a really good interview, actually.
In the games I've seen at Old Trafford so far this season, Phelan tends to be the person second most in the technical area. So it tends to be McKenna first, then it tends to be Phelan. And yeah, like you say, he very much tends to ask for aggression and a higher intensity, especially when the United are attacking. Another question here from Andrew McCarthy at AndrewMook_6. Thoughts on the future of Axel Tuanzebe? He's 24 this year and should be playing regular football soon. Andrew says he's disappointed that Tuanzebe hasn't played more this year, given his performance against Paris Saint-Germain and the constant criticism of other defenders. Given United's links to other centre-backs, do you think Tuanzebe could be lost in the shuffle? Andy, you just spoke a little about Tuanzebe's connections with Nicky, but what do you think about the young defender?
He's got to be playing first-team football. He's got to establish himself somewhere, and he's clearly got a level when he does as he did in Paris, but then a couple of other games he's made mistakes, and he's very highly rated. He's been very unlucky with injuries. As a person, I've not heard anything but absolute positives about him and the way that he's come through the club, and he's captained every single age group, including the first team. And I think in some ways you're looking at a Gerard Piquet situation where he's got to get in because he needs to be playing first team football. But it's different because he's not ready to get in all of the time. And also there's no Vidic and Ferdinand there. We've spoken continuously about United central defenders. United mm-hmm. have been scouting central defenders. If United were absolutely convinced that Axel Tuanzebe was going to come through and improve another 10%, they wouldn't be scouting central defenders. So that tells you what you need to know. If a club came in for Axel and offered good money for him, I think United would be tempted for that. I think publicly Ollie would still talk about him being a great lad and having a good future at the club. But I don't think he's played enough games this season, partly because of his injuries. And I can remember speaking to Nicky Butt about him in 2017 and him saying he'll be better than any of the players that we've got in that position. And not quite happened, unfortunately. And we've seen like these heights of Paris, but these massive troughs. And that is a frustration. He's clearly got everything. Has he got it to be a top-level player at Manchester United? I think the jury's still out on that. And it can't be out for much longer. He's 24, as you said.
I know he had some injury problems regarding some foot surgery, and one of the pins inserted into his foot unfortunately fell out, which sort of delayed one of his processes. From what I've seen so far, he very much looks like a player who he performs better when he's in the starting lineup rather than one coming off the bench. And I think that's just in general for the defensive players at Manchester United at the moment. If the defender is given a starting position, they tend to play a little bit better rather than, say, coming off the bench. And I think that says more about the defensive shape of United right now rather than the player itself.
Agree there, really, Carl. Yeah, you've done some good work, haven't you? When after he made that starting role at PSG, and I think everyone thought, okay, here we go. This is his time now to take the mantle and, you know, drop back out of the team when Harry Maguire was fit, as you'd understand. And as Andy says, a few errors that have perhaps just made Solskjaer think again about giving him a run. But listen, we've already got Eric Bailly, sounding like he's perhaps a little bit, unhappy at the fact that he hasn't been playing more regularly, but you've got Victor Lindelof as well. So it's a difficult balancing act for Solskjaer. And I agree with Andy. I think Tuan David is now at an age where he wants to be playing regularly. So it's one to watch perhaps in the summer.
One further fun question from Wavy Dash at United LW, who simply asks, would you rather fight 10 goose-sized Haalands or 10 Haaland-sized geese?
This is payback for me tweeting the more creative questions have a better chance. I guess I'd probably rather fight 10 goose-sized Haalands, because, 10 Haaland-sized geese, that's just a fearsome prospect. He's absolutely massive, isn't he?
He is a very large boy. The thing that really scared me, I think it was when he won the Golden Boy Award and he took a photograph with his shorts, and you clicked it open and you saw the size of his quadriceps. And I went, yep, I don't want to be playing that guy in goals in five-a-side at all. So, I'll take the mini-sized Haalands myself. Andy, this is some serious journalism. Who are you going to fight?
The geese-sized ones. I've really been thinking about this. This is the hardest question I've been asked today. Yeah, he's a physical specimen, isn't he, Haaland? He's extremely impressive. I watched him a couple of weeks ago in person, and he's huge. Which is not groundbreaking news.
No, but it's really interesting where, you consider how many football players, professional football players, are over 6 foot. I'm not going to make the joke. How many footballers are over 6 foot? So for a striker to look huge on the television, they must truly be quite physically imposing. To any listeners who fancy a little trip down memory lane, look up Haaland's goal against PSG, but try and find the German commentator when he simply exclaims, super tall. When the ball hits the back of the net, it's quite aesthetically pleasing to me. But I think that's the end of this week's episode of Talk of the Devils. Thank you so much, Laurie.
Cheers, Carl. Cheers, Andy. Thanks for listeners.
Thank you so much, Andy.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks, Laurie. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
And it's a thank you from me. That's another episode of Talk of the Devils, a Manchester United podcast brought to you from The Athletic. We'll see you sometime next week. Bye-bye.
The Athletic.